FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 1:29:19. Hey, as always, we invite you to be a part of the show. Email us. The email address is kl@kerrylutz.com. Well, social justice. I've never understood what the term means. I don't know how justice can be social or how social can be justice. As a lawyer, justice is justice, and I'm a recovering attorney, as you know. Well, the person you're about to hear from has written a book, Unjust, Social Justice, and the Unmaking of America. You've read his work over at Commentary. You've seen him on MSNBC, NBC. I'm talking about Noah Rothman. Noah, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, social justice, first of all, what the heck is social justice? The first time I heard it was when Andrew Cuomo, now governor of New York, he was attorney general, and he set up the Department of Social Justice. So how can justice be social, or social be justice?
Yeah, I think you've set up the conundrum pretty well. In my view, there really is no such thing. There is really only justice. It's become the nature of this ideology to develop disparate tracks for individuals in order to address perceived imbalances and historical wrongs that are attributable to accidents of birth. And so they've established this idea that institutions need to be dedicated to the pursuit of social justice, which would compel these institutions to treat individuals unequally in the pursuit of equality. Mm-hmm. And that is antithetical to the idea of justice. You know, individuals who aren't really well accustomed to this idea or familiar with social justice activists might think that this is a pretty anodyne concept, an unobjectionable ideal, even a very American one, just a way to think about fairness and a just society. But it has become the antithesis of blind, objective justice, the kind that we pursue in a courtroom. It necessitates discrimination now and prejudice and downward social leveling, negative discrimination. It saps its adherence of agency. It informs them that they are not they have no agency, that they are not the masters of their own destiny, that they require the aid of enlightened liberal Sherpas to navigate a complex matrix of discrimination, and it distorts their understanding of what politics can actually achieve. The United Right. States is simply not equipped to create the institutions that they think require the downward leveling that is necessary to achieve this kind of historical justice. So when these activists become so steeped in an ideology that it creates expectations for them that cannot go met, it renders them either dispassionate and disillusioned so that they abandon the political process altogether, or they endorse extra political activities, which frequently, all too frequently and increasingly, in fact, manifest in violence. Right. It's an ideology that has run counter to the American idea, and this book is designed to be how you identify it in the wild, and also how you begin to stigmatize these ideas so that they will no longer have the deleterious effect on the American civic compact that I see them having.
And it certainly does. I remember first we had the term diversity. And diversity, you have colleges, you have government, you have companies that are looking for diversity. And then I read the best definition of diversity that I've ever seen, Noah. And that was diversity is celebrating our differences while pretending not to notice them. And all of this is a conflict with reality, because you can't celebrate your differences while you don't notice them, pretend that there aren't any. And isn't this what the left does? Hey, I'm different than you. I'm African-American. You know, I grew up in a poor home, so diversity, include me because I deserve to be included. But don't treat me like I'm any different, even though the reason why you're going to include me is because I am different. There's an inherent conflict in all of this social justice stuff, intersectionality, all that, because it all premises that we're different, but we really there is no difference between us. Men are the same as women. Women are the same as men. Yet more men wind up in science than women. But that's just discrimination. It's not because of any inherent difference, right?
Well, there is you sort of identify the cognitive dissonance in this movement. This book is certainly not an attack on the idea of self-actualization or even racial awareness. It is an attack on what has become the left and the social justice left in particular, their antipathy towards color blindness. That has become an obstacle to the pursuit of true justice, historical justice. You've seen attacks on the ACLU from without and even from within, for example, because they are dispassionate in the litigation of constitutional civil liberties because they have, quote unquote, applied colorblind logic to that pursuit. And that is morally obtuse from the perspective of a social justice advocate. You cannot adjudicate historical wrongs while being blind to the notion that those wrongs were perpetrated by a particular group against a particular group. Likewise, and you've identified the cognitive dissonance in how they apply this logic to gender roles, and not gender stereotypes, but gender roles. I have a chapter on some of the truths, the inviolable truths, that have offended social justice advocates on the right and the left. By the way, this is not a phenomenon that is exclusive entirely to the left, though it is primarily limited to them. There are social justice advocates on the right who appeal to the state for redress of grievances perceived to be done against entire groups and demographics based on accidents of birth. The notion that there is a genetic disposition that makes a person a man or a person a woman is anathema because it can be used by individuals who are insensitive to offend people who don't, for mm-hmm. example, identify as one way or the other. This book is not an attack on, for example, individuals who want to identify a particular pronoun. I don't particularly care one way or another how you identify. It is, however, an attack on an effort to reshape and remold truths in order to fit a particular political narrative. When objectivity becomes the enemy of a political program, it's not objectivity that needs to go.
That's such a great point. And I see you, Noah, as kind of a triumvirate. You, Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, you're kind of pushing the objectivist theme work of the concept of, look, we can have equality of opportunity, but no matter what happens, we're never going to have equality of outcome because of the very diversity that you want us to include here. We're all different. The sexes are different. And there are just certain things, like I don't like seeing a small female police officer patrolling the streets on her own. Maybe she is a triple black belt in kung fu and can take on any guy who comes after her. But generally speaking, smaller women, probably not a good idea to have them patrolling dangerous neighborhoods on their own. And then you got to say, well, maybe they shouldn't be on the beat. Maybe they should be in the station. Am I being prejudicial? Am I in need of a social justice warrior to adjust my attitude here, Noah?
Well, I wouldn't call you prejudicial at all, sir. But I do think that the ideology that I'm prescribing here is one that would identify individuals as being subordinate to the demographic character traits that they're born into. So a female police officer, for example, or a female member of a combat unit who manages to go through the rigorous training necessary to qualify them for that sort of a duty is all you would need to do in order to affect the kind of social leveling that social justice advocates seem to adhere to. They have to abandon objectivity in the perception of individuals as individuals in order to justify their political program. And I do think that that's generally dangerous. Again, I'm not advocating for a particular line of thought when it comes to these very narrow hypotheticals that you bring up, because that's beyond the scope of this book. It is, however, a much broader 30,000-foot perspective on what I perceive to be a philosophy that has confused enlightenment with stereotypes And that is, again, it's not limited to the left or the right. And it's one of these things that I think it legitimizes a political program that can be prejudicial. So it's something that I do think needs to be combated. I don't have any particular problem with your hypothetical necessarily. I do have a problem with amending the guidelines that would allow somebody to qualify for that kind of a duty in order to achieve the social leveling that social engineers think would be necessary to affect historical grievances. So if women have been historically excluded from that sort of a duty, that we need to amend the statutes necessary for them to achieve that status, because they are the obstacle, not the fact that this individual didn't qualify for it. That's what I'm attacking. That's the problem.
I gotcha. And talking about these millennial social justice warriors, or SJWs, as they refer to them, I'm having a conversation with my son about this. And he's like a millennial, and he's totally bought into the concept of hate speech being suppressed. And I said, we have this thing in the U.S. called the First Amendment. Hundreds of thousands of people have died to protect it. It was a major innovation by the framers of the Constitution and the founders of the country to allow you to say what you want. You don't have a right to be heard, but you do have a right to say it, as long as you're not violating criminal statutes, proposing the overthrow of the U.S. government, which doesn't seem to matter anymore. But you're allowed to say this because you don't have a constitutional right about being offended. And I don't know that I made much progress, but this is something I find extremely distressing, Noah, that in the name of not offending people, they're willing to abrogate the Constitution, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, because let's face it, without the Second Amendment, you don't really have a First Amendment. We've seen this over and over again. And all the other amendments that go along with it, the right to due process, the right to not have your property taken. It's all interconnected. There's not just one right. All these rights are a web, and you kind of get rid of one, you kind of dismantle the web.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Egypt is on the verge, once again, becoming a world-renowned gold producer. The Golden Age is being rediscovered. For millennia, ancient Egyptian kingdoms prospered from unparalleled riches. Pharaohs built their empires and flaunted their abundant wealth that was made possible by the country's resource-rich gold deposits. Despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. Aton Resources is at the center of the modern Egyptian mining world, diligently working both as the only public exploration company in Egypt today and as the advocate for mining reform with the Egyptian government. However, those that arrive early, like Aton, will reap the best rewards. Aton's discovery of the legendary lost mountain of gold at Rudruin and its current aggressive drilling program there could potentially reap those rewards. Aton Resources is focused on its 100% owned Abu Marwat concession in the Arabian-Nubian Shield, located 200 kilometers north of Sentimen Sakkari's world-class gold mine. Aton possesses first-mover advantage in the underfollowed jurisdiction of Egypt, which is currently undergoing mining reform. To stay on top of Aton's latest drill results and news, go to AtonResources.com. Aton trades on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Absolutely. And I'm as close to a free speech absolutist as I think you can get. And not because I think that all ideas are tolerable. I think that some ideas are intolerable. But the only way in which you render them stigmatized is by exposing them to sunlight, giving their advocates as much room as possible and as much rope as they possibly can to give the public a really good look at what those ideas really mean. And what you've seen, what you're describing here, the attack on certain ideas, I don't see yet the advocate yet is the key word, the advocacy for a public sector solution to the problem of dangerous speech, criminalizing speech. That's anathema, as you said, and it's against the Constitution. It is, however, a program to stigmatize certain ideas and to deplatform, which is something you see on college campuses pretty frequently, to deny individuals with whom you disagree the opportunity to espouse those ideas in places that are not public own spaces, so it has no bearing constitutionally. It's merely a decision by a private institution about what they like and what they don't like. And it's perfectly constitutional and legal. It is, mm-hmm. however, dangerous for the national conversation, not because exposing those ideas to the public will create a whole new cast of adherence to them, although it may, but by driving them underground, you create a taboo. And that taboo is not so easily addressed in the public, and it makes those ideas much more sexy and tolerable to individuals who are now underground and cannot be policed by what Jane Jacobs called the eyes on the street, a sort of organic, natural civic compact that polices itself. That's the sort of thing that I think is a very conservative idea, because it has nothing to do with the public sector. It arises naturally, like the marketplace. And the marketplace of ideas has a tendency in this country, especially, to stigmatize and anathematize notions of inequality and oppression and segregation that are not addressed in law, but are nevertheless unpalatable to a broad swath of the general public. And that's the sort of thing that I think is being lost, as you describe, in this new movement towards an artificial policing of the dialogue that has very little to do with the natural marketplace of ideas and is much more an outgrowth of social justice activism.
And I always kind of grew up and I went to law school, and it was always, hey, if you've got the better argument, if you really believe what you're saying is right, then why should you be upset over what somebody else says? Why should that intimidate you? And why should it make you want to restrict their right so that yours is the only point of view held? I mean, I'm looking at like climate change, and I think there's a legitimate discussion to be had. And I kind of withheld my opinion, although I'm more inclined to think that man doesn't create this so-called global warming. They're certainly getting a nasty dose of it in Chicago this week, minus 60 degrees below with the wind chill factor. But isn't it worthy of a discussion? And yet the left seeks to undermine discourse at every opportunity and under the guise of settled science, right?
Well, yeah, and there is no such thing as settled science. One of the phenomena that I describe in the book is sort of the social justification, for lack of a better word, of the sciences, which has a little less to do with climate change and much more to do with genetics and gender. And the idea, for example, that individuals who seek to transition from one gender to another might be so inclined to transition back, or that children should be taking hormone blockers, which are not approved by the FDA and are not especially well tested. And we don't really know how the effects that they have, although we do know that they may inhibit brain development and bone growth. And this sort of thing, just noting that, is deemed prejudicial and has become, for a certain segment of political activists, not scientific-minded individuals, but activists, to be anathema and to be something that should be driven underground. They're confusing prejudice, I think, with skepticism, and that is something that should absolutely be resisted. When you saw, for example, when Donald Trump was inaugurated, you had a variety of marches. One of them was the so-called March for Science, and that March for Science was very quickly overtaken by a class of activists who confused the scientific process with political activism from the left and began pursuing ideas and related to racial justice and comedy and progressive taxation and all sorts of things that have very little and anything to do with the sciences. And because the community of scientists has a general left-leaning bent, in particular in the public sector, the public sciences, is that they were amenable to being hijacked by this movement. And I think it did quite a lot of damage to their persona, the idea that this is an objectivist movement that can be treated as something that is purely rational and is above the political fray. It is not. And all these institutions that are being co-opted by this movement, I believe, are probably going to regret their passivity.
Yeah. Well, we have a problem, obviously, with the educational system in the country. These millennials really don't understand history. They don't understand how the Bill of Rights came to be. They don't understand that rights flow from God, whether you believe in God or not, but there are natural rights, natural law, and that all these rights do not flow from government. They believe that government is superior to the individual. Our founding fathers, and probably you and myself, believe that government is there to serve society, serve the individual, serve you and I, and protect us, often from others, enemies within and without. Their whole concept of government is really kind of messed up, and that's really kind of the basis of social justice, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure where it begins for the social justice left, the antipathy toward American founding ideals. But there is an idea of a sort of retributive politics that has begun to consume America's most engaged activists and elites on the social justice left that is antithetical to the American experience because it prescribes social leveling, of a kind that cannot simply be achieved by American institutions. As you say, they're not designed to achieve that. In fact, they're designed to thwart that. It is the ideal of late 20th century, for example, affirmative action activists to rise individuals up who have been mistreated historically. That was positive discrimination, and the effects of positive discrimination were desirable. And even if they had some negative effects, individuals were negatively discriminated against as a result of quotas, for example, that was collateral damage. And it was sort of sotto voce that it was discussed, if it was discussed at all. But it was, an undesirable outgrowth of a necessary political program. Today, it's a little different. The positive discrimination is the collateral damage. Negative discrimination is the design. You are to negatively discriminate against individuals who have achieved historical privilege as a result of no action of their own. And that is the intended outgrowth. If some individuals benefit from that process, well, so be it. But the effect will be to achieve negative social leveling in order to achieve some sort of historical justice. And that is antithetical to the American experience. And it leads to disillusionment and bitterness when it cannot be achieved. And for some, again, that will result in disengagement from the political process and unresponsiveness. But for others, it results in the sort of resolution to accept the fact that American institutions are simply flawed, irreparably so, and that it is necessary to take action into our own hands. And that action takes the form of extra political activity and even violence. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing that I think we need to address pretty quickly, because this is a philosophy that is becoming much more popular.
And it's a bit scary. And where does it end? It's really the problem. I think you really done a service writing this book, because it really sums up the argument, and I've been reading it, and I wanted to talk to you quickly about the Ukraine, because that's a society where you explored personally, where this notion of fairness doesn't really exist. Fairness towards treating people, fairness, basically it's okay to persecute your political enemies through the judicial system because they deserve it. And that's kind of...
Well, I've studied the region very closely, and I traveled there briefly in the winter of 2017 on a government junket, and we had the privilege of sitting across from the country's chief prosecutor, who explained to us rather matter-of-factly that it is in our interest as us, members of Western institutions, democratic institutions, to support the government, the pro-Western government, we were pointedly reminded, in their efforts to achieve post-revolutionary justice after the Maidan. The Maidan protests, in which over 100 people died, many of which were victims of pro-Russian elements and the ousted regime that was a pro-Russian government. But it was not the priority of this democratic government, the current president, we were informed, to prosecute individuals who were engaged in violence on their side. Mm-hmm. Because that was just simply not a priority. And that to me was a really disheartening moment. It was a sort of an admission that this post-revolutionary culture had no interest in objective justice, but merely retribution. And that's the kind of society that can arise when these sentiments of retributive social justice are left unchecked. And it's a future that I hope this country and the West generally avoids.
Yeah, it should be rejected out of hand. I mean, the whole point of our system is to stop that very thing from occurring. And that's what's really scary, is that the millennials, the social justice warriors, don't seem to care about it. It seems to be a normal part of the system. Hey, so I guess we find unjust social justice and the unmaking of America wherever fine books used to be sold, as well as Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com.
Yes, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever you get your books, you can get them there. Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Hey, all, if you got a question for Noah, myself, email us, kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, and Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Noah, we wish you great luck on the book. It certainly is timely and really in need. Hopefully some of those SJWs will be reading the book and taking the message to heart. Good luck. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.